again, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Glow West podcast, where we chat about sex, sexuality, and the body. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline West, and as always, I'm delighted to be part of the Tortoise Shack Network, where you can find tons of podcasts on politics, culture, society, and sex. If you like what we do, please do consider supporting us at patreon.com/tortoiseshack, as it really does help to keep the mics on, or please pop over to Apple to rate and review. Today, I'm talking about something that affects a lot more people than what you might think, because we haven't had any education on this. So, you know, we have a lot of stereotypes and lack of information to confront. But my guests today are here to fill in some of those gaps. We're talking about intersex today. My first guest is Diana James, and she is a strategic advisor with Devon and Cornwall Police on violence against women and girls and hate crime. She also sits on the promotion boards for senior officers within that force. She's worked on domestic and sexual abuse within refuges for both men and women, and this has included working with various members of the LGBTQIA plus community. She's currently a mature student preparing for a career change as a counsellor in LGBTQIA plus issues around identity, including both domestic abuse and sexual assault. My second guest today is Tania Ní Verhuelle, who is an assistant professor in the School of Law and Government in Dublin City University. She researches the impact of law on the human body. She advises governments, civil servants, and national and international NGOs on legislation and public policy in her areas of expertise. Tania was appointed to the Gender Recognition Act Review in 2017, and she's currently the principal investigator on an IRC-funded project entitled Mapping the Lived Experience of Intersex, Variations of Sex Characteristics in Ireland. Thank you both for joining me. What a wealth of experience to approach this topic with.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Me too.
So I suppose when we start at the beginning, and maybe some people don't really understand what being intersex is. So do each of you want to give me a little definition of how you understand the term and what that means in reality? Diana, we might start with you on that one.
Well, I've got no idea. Absolutely none, because it's such a wide thing. Being intersex, there is just such a variation of who we are. There is no one, oh, I'm this one person, therefore there's thousands of others, because we're all so very different. We fit within a broad umbrella, but we are individuals within that.
That makes sense. And I suppose it makes it more complicated to have these conversations when there's not one particular definition, I suppose. So Tania, what about yourself?
I'd agree with what Diana said. It's a very hard term to define, and language in this space is hugely contested. So people get very hot under the collar about what term you use to describe a particular way of being. But I suppose if we're looking for a definition so your listeners kind of understand what we're talking about, one that's being bandied about in European circles and by the UN is that intersex is an umbrella term that describes a situation where a person's sex characteristics don't align in the way we may typically think of as male or female.
And I mean, male and female are contested terms, you know, in modern society now anyway. So I suppose it's no surprise to hear that intersex would be the same for all of it. You mentioned their language, and I know language changes quite rapidly. And, you know, Diane, you're not a young 20-year-old. You've lived this experience for a while. So I'm sure you've seen the different terms transform over the years. What are your thoughts on how that's gone, and where would you like it to go?
I think the change has been amongst what we've been called as to the language we now use for ourselves. I think that's the major difference, and that language we use for ourselves is being more taken up and respected than it used to be. We were called terrible things in the past, whereas now we debate amongst ourselves as much as the outside world does over about what we call ourselves, how we regard ourselves, and who we are. And that's ongoing. Language is a flexible thing.
And I know, Tania, when you're doing your research at the moment on the experience of people who are intersex in Ireland, getting any kind of research project defined is half the battle when you're trying to get it there off the ground at first. So how did you approach that issue of definitions?
Well, we are using the terms intersex and variations of sex characteristics. So we're using both of those terms, and we're trying to, I guess, in a way, what we're trying to do is we just want to know what the story is with intersex in Ireland. So anytime we try to, or I have tried to intervene to look at, a reform of laws or policies or practices or guidelines, we keep hitting this roadblock, which is that there's a complete absence of knowledge about intersex in Ireland at any level in society. And so when you're plugging for change, the government sort of says, well, what is this? You know, how big a deal is this? You know, this is a tiny thing. This isn't a real thing. This doesn't happen here. We're a diversity positive country. I loved this. This was their answer to the UN when the UN asked them, you know, what are you doing to protect intersex people from surgeries and interventions that they haven't consented to themselves? The government said, oh, no. Ireland is a diversity positive country. We have marriage equality. We have gender recognition. We have a really good anti-FGM bill. So, you know, we don't do that here. But none of those measures capture intersex experience. And so every time we try to agitate for change, we hit this roadblock. And so the whole point of this project is quite literally to work out what the story with intersex is, so we get baseline information, so we have the information there to turn around and say, this is the Irish experience of intersex. Lots of different experiences, but here's what's common, here's what we're seeing, here's, you know, the people on the ground telling us what their lives are like. And, you know, we've been so grateful to everybody who has shared their story with us, because it makes it easier for us to tell the intersex story then when we're looking for change.
It's kind of shocking in one way, but it's also not, because this is Irish society and we haven't been great at talking about much, as an understatement for a lot of things. But, you know, like, we have kids who are born with all sorts of things going on at birth, you know, from cleft palates to everything. There's so much going on. But it seems to be when it comes to intersex, that silence seems to be really pervasive, and it's almost like, again, shame and stigma are really attached to that, and shame and stigma have been really attached to sex and gender in Ireland for so long, and I'm sure Diane in the UK as well. But do you think, like, is that essentially what it is? It's shame and stigma that perpetuates that sense of silence.
I think it's also discrimination, because still call it, when you, I call it like coming out. I've come out so many times, there's so many different things. I sort of came out in the community as being Jewish, came out as being lesbian, and then coming out as being intersex. Because when you start speaking about intersex issues, that's what it is. You're coming out, you're opening yourself up to discrimination, misunderstanding, accusations, everything. So why so many people that are intersex do not come out is really so understood, because I see being lesbian, gay, bisexual and trans as being more acceptable within certain communities than being intersex is, mostly because very few people understand who we are. And if they don't understand it, they avoid it or they discriminate against it.
Do you think it's down to a lack of education? I mean, I can't remember ever having any conversations about intersex or any conversation about gender, I suppose, at all in school or even in college, or really seeing it in the media, unless it was, you know, like some of the old school names and it was presented as a very sensationalist kind of approach.
And even at that, the presentation was so rare. I think, like, I agree with Diane. I think there is a discrimination there, but there's also a complete absence of knowledge. So we were so ingrained into thinking, is it Pierre Bourdieu who says that it comes without saying, it goes without saying because it comes without saying? So nobody, you just don't expect that there would be anything other than male or female, because that's what we're so encultured into thinking, that the ways of being are in the world, and that these are clearly defined, indisputable characteristics. And you know, it's one of those things you could never change about yourself that would be, you know, it's clear, you'd know, it's obvious. It's the first thing we say to someone when we hear someone's had a baby. Oh, is it a boy or a girl? That puts huge social pressure on parents of children who are born with ambiguous genitalia, which is only one aspect of intersex experience. It's only the tip of the iceberg. It's by no means the full experience. But anyone who's heard that thinks that ambiguous genitalia at birth is the whole intersex story, and it's not. And so I think it's the pressure that parents, I mean, at a super vulnerable time when you've just had a baby, your hormones are all over the place, you know, you're very, very vulnerable. And if the first thing you encounter is a negative experience, well, that will frame your interaction with the whole issue. So if instead of someone saying, oh, you've a boy, or you've a daughter, or you've a son, they go, oh, like, that's not a good noise when your baby is born. And it doesn't matter what the issue is that comes after that. Oh, we've set the scene as this is not good. It doesn't matter whether it is, as you said, a cleft palate, whether it is Down syndrome, whether it is an intersex baby. It doesn't matter what it is. That noise cuts the feet out from under all parents. And then if everybody's texting you saying, what's the name? Is it a boy or is it a girl? That's a huge social pressure. And when it's something you've never heard of before, you don't have the language to articulate it, people aren't really listening to what you're saying because they're desperate to hear what they expect to hear, that creates a whole storm, really, that makes it really, really difficult from that moment on.
I saw, when doing research for this, an article in The Guardian, and it was parents of an intersex child, and they were told once the baby was born by the doctors, so it was an intersex baby, they said, don't tell anyone the baby is born. And they had to investigate to see what was going on. But you can't keep the birth of a baby secret for months at a time. And like you said, that you have that constant pressure of people, like, they know you're pregnant. They know that a pregnancy is 9 months. You know, if you've gone a year, they're going to think, okay, they're either like not a human species or there's something kind of going on. But like, that's, it just doesn't seem to be like any kind of ethical or healthy way to approach the subject, just to say, just pretend you haven't given birth.
It's also the issue around, then there's the pressure to normalize the child, to make it agender, so that it's therefore acceptable. So the parents are in that situation where they've got no understanding of what is going on. The doctor's knowledge is not always as good as it could be. And then they're forced into making a choice, or they feel they're forced into making a choice, because there's very little advice out there for the parents. And if they make that choice, how strong is the reliability of that choice as being the right one for that child? Because I know personally that mistakes happen. Choices can be made that are the wrong ones. And putting it right later is so much harder than trying to get it sorted correctly in the first place, by letting that child grow and make their own educated choices, as long as there's not an immediate medical need for any operations to take place, then let the child grow, let the child choose and see who they are. They may choose to have no operations. They may choose to not be male or female. Or they might make a choice in, I'm a boy, I'm a girl. But making that choice as an almost a snap decision or pressured decision then can lead those parents into making a decision that they then feel guilty over, possibly for the rest of their lives. And the impact it can have on the child is lifelong.
Yeah, I mean, I've had Eddie Berry on the podcast before, who is intersex and also identifies as trans. And they say the doctors basically flipped a coin and they got it wrong. And, you know, now, like, they have to deal with those consequences of that snap decision for the rest of their lives, and, you know, in pain with the surgeries, and like the societal impact of that, and the family trying to accept it, and all those kind of things. And like, you know, Addie's, I think, in, I don't want to give her age away, but, you know, not newborn, basically. But is this the case in Ireland that these surgeries are still going ahead, Tanya, or are they more a thing of the past now?
It sort of depends who you're talking to, Caroline. So there is a sort of a differentiation based on age. So older people certainly, but it's not just even age. I don't want to categorize things like that. It sort of depends who you meet, right? So it depends what practitioner you meet and what their response is and what they know about the issue and what access they have to, you know, in terms of support. So if you're born in a, and I'm just saying this off the top of my head, not kind of drawing on anybody's story, but if you're born in the middle of nowhere in a small, you know, rural hospital where, you know, births themselves are unusual. You know, it's not like you're born at the National Maternity Hospital where there's a couple of hundred a day babies being born. But if you're born somewhere where the birth of a baby is a once a week thing or a once a fortnight thing, then the first people that you meet, I mean, they're going to be very special staff if they've ever encountered this before, if they have ever thought about how to manage it, because even medical staff, and I don't want to kind of be demonizing doctors because they're doing the best they can with what they have, and they don't necessarily also get the best training on the issue. And there is a lack of I suppose there's lots of different people take different approaches, and until relatively recently in 2006, there were many different approaches floating around. And it's not like when you take out an appendix, right? There's a way to take out an appendix that most people can agree on what you're doing. Everyone understands where it is, what it's about, what you do, how the procedure works. There are protocols. There are no protocols when it comes to treating intersex people, because every intersex body is different and they're all going to respond differently to the interventions that are done. And there has been a complete absence of longitudinal studies. So we don't know if you intervene and you do this today, what impact that's going to have on a person in 5, 10, 15, 25 years time. We don't know what the cost for that person is going to be. And nor does the medical profession, because they haven't scientifically charted it. And so really, every intervention that you're doing is kind of an experiment, because you don't really know what's going to happen until you've intervened, and then you see, and then you respond, you know. So there's no protocol. So it is a very fluid thing, and that absence of certainty from a medical perspective must make treating challenging for doctors, and it's particularly challenging then obviously for the person who's being treated, particularly if the initial treatment is, as Diana said, not something that's medically necessary to preserve the health or the life of the person being treated, but actually what you're treating is a social anxiety in someone else who's not actually your patient. You know, you're treating a parent's worry as opposed to the needs of the embodied baby in front of you.
Diana, how does that make you feel then, going through everything you've gone through, and to know that now at this stage in 2020, there's still that ambiguity and perhaps social pressure on top of that ambiguity, making a very toxic sounding mix?
Well, it's partly the reason why I and a few others have come out, is to try and make a difference for those coming along behind. It's still a certain amount of secrecy involved. My family, for instance, never told me anything about being intersex. I just thought I was strange, weird, odd, that my body was different. Their arguments were my fault, as it was always about me. So children then sort of take those things in and they blame themselves for what is not necessarily their fault. And so I didn't know. I just knew that I was different. I felt different. I didn't seem the same as anyone else. And then when I hit puberty, my body changed in ways that were unexpected. So I started like growing breasts. The hair on my body didn't grow in certain ways. My body didn't form in the ways that it was expected, which I was already being bullied for being different. But when that sort of thing starts to happen, I then got sexually abused as well at school. So that's the secrecy around intersex. It's like the parents don't want to say, and when you go against what their decision was, they either feel shamed or guilty or blame you for going against their wishes. It's a very hard thing for an intersex child, especially, who has no understanding of who they are and what their body is, to find these things out on their own.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I mean, like, puberty is hard enough for anyone. And then when we have things like porn, you know, to come into factors with genitals like right up in our faces, and then yours don't look like that or whatever. It just must be just, yeah, such a mess. And again, that silence. And if you don't know what it's called, you mightn't necessarily know what to Google or, you know, what support services are out there outside of the family unit, if you're able to access resources outside the family unit, if you have a supportive family or not. So I don't know. I think in Ireland, Tania, at the moment, do we have specialist support services for intersex people?
Not really, no. We have, you're very lucky if you hit across a healthcare professional or an allied healthcare professional who has encountered it before. So I suppose the things through this study is we've met one or two healthcare professionals who do know what they're doing and who are trained in the area and know what to do to give support. But a lot of intersex people are telling us that when they meet healthcare professionals throughout their lives, the first thing they have to do is to teach your healthcare provider about your healthcare issue before you can access treatment. And you might need treatment for something totally different. You could have cataracts. So not whatsoever to do with being intersex, but because you're going to someone for the first time and they're taking your medical history, that's the bit they're going to zone in on, and you're going to waste your hour and your €250 or whatever it is telling this eye doctor who has no business knowing about anything else, all about your intersex condition, before they'll even look at the yolk in your eye to look at treating that. And that's just an appalling way of being. And that seems to echo so much with, like, the experience that, you know, I read and that intersex people around the world have told me, that you get no private space of your own for your private space, where everyone else expects to be, you know, kind of circles back to what Diana was saying, like, where everyone else expects to have autonomy and respect and privacy at the private parts of your body. That can be gone if you're an intersex person. So if you're in hospital, you know, you can be there for whatever reason. And if it's on your chart, you might find that because you're a teaching hospital, that many, many, many people are going to come along and they're going to want to look and they're going to want to examine you and they're going to want to poke around because they've never seen this before and they want to see what it's like. And, like, there's one of those stories I read in one of the books, someone saying she was sitting there in the hospital bed eating her dessert as a teenager, and a whole bunch of young doctors came in, most of whom were male. They were all student doctors. And while she was there eating her apple pie or whatever it was, the sort of teaching instructor was saying, oh, now and here we have, and listed off the whole thing. And then all 20 of them got to have a good rummage around while she was finishing her dessert. And she did not have the power, because they took it from her, to be able to say, stop this. Don't do this. I don't want to be touched here. And that is a horrendous thing to do to anybody. It's not surprising many intersex people report feeling traumatized by their engagements with the system when that's what the system's doing to people.
I can tell you a little thing about that. When I was younger, I got raped and I was lying in hospital. I'd been badly beaten as well. And a troop of doctors came in with one senior doctor, and I was lying there on pain medication, and he took a pen out and then started rummaging around my genitalia with his pen to point out different things to the other doctors.
Oh my God.
And then as he left, I could hear his pen hit the bin. It went bong, because he threw his pen away, because it had touched me.
Oh my God.
Oh, that's awful.
I don't even have the words for the rage. Like, you should never have had to experience that.
No, but that's, we aren't people.
It's not, it's unfortunately not an atypical experience, which is the horrendous thing.
Yeah, we're
any, any wonder people don't say, any wonder people don't come out.
I just want to go smash something. Like the rage of that, like, you know, people lose autonomy a lot of the time in medical situations as it is, but, you know, you'd think that they would have a bit of cop on, even common sense and decency, to not do something like that. It doesn't matter what training you have, what access to training, that's just being a decent human being to not do something like that. But yet they seem just so cavalier about it.
And they just don't care. I could hear every word they were saying. You know, I could hear the sort of thing, oh, and here we have the vagina and let's have a look at the vagina. And this is what they were saying whilst he was prodding me with a pen. And there was half a dozen doctors staring.
Jesus, like, I just... Yeah, I don't, like, I'm lost for words. I have the privilege of not having that experience. How do you move on from that, Diana, and not want to just destroy everything in a fit of rage, a very justified fit of rage after that?
Because you've got no choice. What are you going to do? This is years ago as well. And then I had the police coming in and they advised me that probably a good idea not to actually formally report it and go to court and stuff. Because if I did, then it would come up in court, oh, this person is intersex. And so then there would be the thing around, oh, well, obviously she asked for it, or she's weird or strange or led him on in some peculiar way. So therefore, you just have to carry on. There is nothing else you can do. You just button it up, put it away and move on. That's the story of so many women. It's just an added layer of intersex, but it's not unusual for that to happen to many women, especially a few years ago.
Yeah.
And do you think that's why that kind of experience formed your desire to work with the police, and you've worked with refuges as well, and you're training to be a counsellor now as well? Like, that's, I mean, I just can't imagine how wonderful it is for an intersex person to find an intersex therapist. Like you said, like, you have to spend all your time, like Tanya said, you know, educating the person first. And we've had conversations about that in Ireland recently about Black people having to educate white therapists about the trauma from racism and them just not getting it and stuff. And but, like, I suppose we don't really have that conversation about trans people or any LGBTI spectrum experiences. But I think that must be very empowering to think that you could be that counsellor and provide that support to someone else that you should have got when you were going through that experience.
It's one of the reasons why I want to do it, is that's because there isn't anybody. I don't know of anybody. I'm sure there are, but I don't know of anyone. And I just want to be there as well for those, not just intersex people, but other people within the LGBTQIA plus community that have been in domestic abuse or sexual abuse situations. Because, as you said, Tanya, the first thing they ask or think of you is, oh, the reason you're speaking to me is because you're lesbian, because you're gay, because you're bi, because you're transgender or queer. That is the underlying reason, when it could have absolutely nothing to do with why you're there. So if I can help someone get past that and actually just into what is the issue that they need to talk to me about, then that's going to be a huge weight from them to discuss something which could be intensely personal to them.
And a lot of time saved as well, and energy, yeah, that you don't have to educate this person. I remember I went to a psychoanalytic conference and we were talking about trans people, and everyone in the room was saying, yeah, but they have really high rates of suicide or self-harm or mental health. And everyone was chipping in with all these reasons why they would have it. And no one said, like, until I stood up and went, well, maybe it's like because of conversations like this, and maybe it's how society treats people like this. It just didn't occur to them. They thought the issue was them being trans, and that was essential to them not holding down jobs rather than being fired by, you know, discriminatory bosses and things. And it just seems... just there's a long way to go, I think, for a lot of people on that. And Tanya, your work, do you work in that area? Like you're obviously it's an early stage study. It's like the first in Ireland, is that correct, of its kind?
It's the first of this type, yeah, because we're wanting to talk to intersex people, but also family members of intersex people. So we see how it's playing out across the board. And then we want to talk to healthcare providers to see how they understand what it means to be intersex, just to know what's happening in Ireland, what practices are being adopted, what approach is being taken. So in that way, triangulating it, I suppose, is different. And it's an interdisciplinary study, so I'm a lawyer. So it's very odd for lawyers to be looking at these kinds of social issues. But I suppose in DCU, I'm lucky we have a socio-legal law school, so we're very interested in how, not just what the law says in the books, but how that works in the real world and what the impact of law is on people's lives. And I think that was one of the things that first struck me when I first heard about intersex. I remember reading one of the very few judgments I could get on the issue, which has thankfully been overruled, but it came from a family court in Brisbane in Australia, and it was a nullity proceedings about a marriage between an intersex man and his wife, and they were contesting whether it was a marriage or not. And the court looked, so this case was in 1978, and the court looked, or 79, sorry, and the court looked at a decision that happened in the English High Court in 1970 about a trans part marriage, a marriage involving a trans person, where they had defined for the first time. So it was only in 1970 for the first time that a legal definition of sex or gender emerged, and they said that your legal sex is determined by the congruence of your chromosomes, gonads, and genitals at the moment of birth. So it's a temporal test and a biological one. And if there was any ambiguity, the court said it would be the genital criterion that would be the dominant one. And so if we dial back to the case in Australia, the court said, well, look, you're non-congruent, Mr. C, so you're neither man nor woman. And if we go back to the 1800s in the case Hyde and Hyde, where Lords Penzance defined marriage as the union of one man and one woman to the exclusion of all others for all time, then you're neither a man nor a woman, and so you have no right to marry anybody at all. And so a basic human right, the right to get married, that anyone would expect to enjoy, is stripped from the intersex person as soon as the reality of their intersexness was seen. And I was horrified by that because I thought, God, we're all supposed to enjoy human rights because we are alive, not because of anything else, but just because we are human beings, and you don't cease to be human because you're an intersex person, but you cease to be a legal person if you're intersex. Now that's thankfully been overruled, but we see that the protections that other people would expect are the laws willing to accept a bit of rough and tumble there, willing to kind of blur the lines, accept a bit of fudging around what is and isn't acceptable in a way that it wouldn't for somebody else. And I really don't like that. But your question was, is it the first of its kind? It is, because we're looking at medicine, we're looking at sociology, we're looking at law, we're trying to put the whole thing in context to literally understand what the story with intersex in Ireland is. It sounds very simple, but that it's no bigger and no smaller than that, but that is pretty big.
But like you're saying there's consequences for everything. If this, intersex people are about 2%, is that right, of the population, give or take?
1.78, the UN says, but yeah.
So that's a lot of people in Ireland, and Diana, in the UK, that's a lot of people. Like you're not talking five people in the country, and even if it was, so what? Like that's still they still deserve every protection going and stuff. But that does have implications for, like you said, the legal aspect. Or Diana, you've worked with people going to refuges, and it's like if you don't physically like look like a stereotypical woman or a man, do you get entry into that refuge? And then that has massive implications for the safety of people who may be vulnerable, and how we look after them, and like we said, the medical approach to things. So I'm curious, having worked in refuges myself, Diana, where they could go to support intersex people more, and what have you found in your work around that area with domestic abuse and how intersex people experience that aspect?
Well, that's a really big question in the fact that will that intersex person decide to come out about being intersex? If they look more gender fluid, for instance, with refuge, you have to pick a gender. You have to pick male or female because there's only male or female refuges. There's one in London run by the Outside Project, which is an LGBTQIA refuge, but that's only there for the pandemic, not afterwards. And that's only got so many spaces. And I should imagine it's constantly full. So that person's got to pick a gender. Which one are they? Although fortunately in the UK, as far as transgender people are concerned, refuge is open to them, male or female. You go to the refuge that is yours. A transgender woman goes to a female refuge, a transgender man goes to a male refuge. And I've dealt with both. And I was part of the Women and Equalities Select Committee on the 2010 Equalities Act. And we gave evidence about the experience of transgender women, particularly because it's always women that seem to get the shitty end of the stick. So we gave evidence about that, and there had not been one single case in about 15 years. And that's the only record we could really go back for a distance of, was about 15 years, and there hadn't been one single incident, and trans women had been accessing refuge in that time. So this whole thing about sort of single sex spaces kind of fell apart as far as that was concerned. But social stuff and that, like around intersex and anything else, it's the reality is someone's belief, not what the actual reality is. And if someone wants to believe something that's completely different, they will do. And you'll never convince them otherwise. And that's what happens with intersex. You know, if you've got a choice, I would imagine you just don't talk about it. Not if you're already in a vulnerable position. And then you're stuck in another vulnerable position. You know, are you going to say anything? Or are you going to keep your mouth shut and try and get through it?
Yeah. And you can't blame anyone for trying to do that, given all the issues that you've both outlined so far. I wonder, is it a Western thing? Is it, you know, the way different cultures around the world have different concepts of genders, and they have third genders and two spirits and all these different approaches that we might necessarily have in a very, you know, maybe Christian, you know, Western kind of society. Is intersex treated differently around the world, or what's the approach?
Well, I suppose in parts of the world where you do have more fluidity, then maybe pressures are slightly different, but many of places where that might have been traditional have been very influenced by Western values. So, you know, anywhere where you've got a post-colonial state, like the values of the colonizer are going to be there still, you know, in a kind of a constant tension with whatever the native values were. I'm not an anthropologist now, so I kind of can't go into it at length. But I mean, in some societies, it does seem that there is a more acceptance of a third gender, but that's not necessarily understood as being an intersexed embodied way of being. It could be being transvestite, or it could mean, you know, it means different things in different parts of the world. It doesn't necessarily mean intersex, but where I suppose you have more of an acceptance, maybe there's less of a pressure. I guess it depends on how the particular families in particular circumstances, what their personal beliefs are, and then what they read into the situation when they have a child who's intersex.
And then, but going back to what you said there again, you know, this is the parents who have the responsibility when the baby is born. And I know in Irish society, as soon as, you know, like you were saying, you know, you have to make that decision. Well, every society, you make that decision of it's a boy or it's a girl. But then you get that legal document with the birth cert, which has an M or an F on it. But if you're going to go and decide, I'm not going to have surgery, I'm not going to enforce a gender on the child, I'm going to wait until they're older and let them figure out for themselves and see how that goes. How does that work then for the legal aspect of not having a gender, so to speak?
Well, you can't not have one. You have to have one. They can't register your birth without one. And you only have two choices. It must be M or F. Now, since the 2004 Civil Registration Act, and that was one of the lovely things that came out of the Gender Recognition Act review group that I was involved in, was that the Office of the Registrar General and Thor Clorhar confirmed that if someone had an intersex condition and had medical documentation to prove that, then they could use the function within the legislation to correct an error on the face of the birth cert. So up until then, but that's untested. Nobody has tested it yet. The only case in Ireland that did challenge that involved a trans person, but in that case, court was very clear to say that their entry on the register was a snapshot of a moment in time, a best guess using the available information that was available at the time that the birth was registered. So it was good to get the clarification, I suppose, that the office would be willing to change for an intersex person, but I'm not aware of anybody having tried that yet. The only case we have had in Ireland about it happened in 2009, where a family had adopted a baby. So the baby was the subject of an intercountry adoption, and the family adopted knowing it was intersex. And when they brought the baby home to Ireland, and there were some tests done to see the extent of it, it discovered that it was a more nuanced form of the particular condition than had originally been understood, and that the child would more likely identify as male than female growing up, but all the documentation said that he was a girl. And so the parents wanted to raise their child as a boy, as a son, and then looked to have the marker on the adoption papers changed, because I suppose we're unusual in Ireland in that we have sex segregated schooling. You know, there's lots of our schools are segregated by gender, and many parts of the world look at us and think that's demented, you know, that this is the norm for the way our schools work. But it does mean that the pressure is sharper than it might be in other contexts. If you live in a town where there is only a boys' school and a girls' school, and you can't register your kid for the school you want to bring them to because the paperwork is wrong. You know, and so in that case in 2009, it was just the judge said on the day, yep, that's fine. Have you a problem with that, to the adoption board? And they went, no. And he said, grand, do it. And that's great for that family. But because it wasn't a proper considered judgment, it's of very limited value for the next family. So the next family would have to have the fight as well. So what it sorted the situation for that family, what it didn't do was create a precedent so that the next family would not have to go to court and have that battle. It didn't change the status quo for everybody, just for that one family. And that's the unfortunate thing when cases don't get properly heard.
I know, I can imagine. And what about Diana over in the UK? Is that the same situation, or is there more freedom to not be a gender and let the child figure it out for themselves?
My experience on this has not been wide, because it's only been the past few years that I've come out as being intersex, and there is so few of us who talk to each other. And of course, we're not an homogenous group. Everybody's got different values. Everybody's got different thoughts. Everybody's got different opinions. So I'm afraid I can't really readily answer that question, because I honestly don't know.
Yeah, well, that's something in itself, that there isn't, you know, a massive support network and open conversations.
It does seem to be in the UK. We're in a slightly different position here in Ireland. So if you're an adult and you want to change your paperwork, you can do that, because we have a self-declaration model of gender recognition. It doesn't require you to be diagnosed as trans. Whereas in the UK, adults who might want to change their documentation will need to almost pretend to be trans in order to be able to access the right to change documentation if you're not happy with the gender that's marked on your documentation. And that's... Like that in itself is completely wrong, that, you know, you have one situation going on, you've one identity, but you have to pretend to be something that you're not in order to access something that you need. And that's less than ideal.
You know, it's part of all this enormous fight that seems to have gone on in the UK around gender critical people. Anyone that is not their idea of what is female or feminine is not a real woman, and that affects intersex people as much as it does affect transgender people. You know, oh, how deep is your vagina? You know, were you born with a uterus? Do you have both ovaries? Do you have only one ovary? Do you have not any ovaries? Well, if you were born intersex and you, for instance, weren't born with ovaries, or you were born with without a uterus, well, you then can't be a woman. You know, it's all around things like that. Or if you were born but you don't have periods, are you still a woman? And they brought up all this stuff that has such a wide-ranging effect. They don't know and they don't care. As far as most of them are concerned, intersex people are collateral damage in their fight to state who is allowed to be called a woman, who is allowed to go and pee in peace. Yeah. It's
toxic.
It's honestly, it is pretty bloody pathetic. Yeah. It really is. It just makes me so angry. I'm a lesbian and I tend to date butch women. That's who I tend to date. Not 100%, but that's who I tend to date. And the amount of times one of them has said, will you come into the loo with me because I'm concerned about getting challenged? They're a woman, born cis woman, but they have short hair, tend to wear like jeans, boots, leather jackets and stuff, no makeup. And they're concerned about being challenged just going to have a pee. You know, it's just... Anyway, that can be said to go into a separate subject, but it's kind of related.
Yeah. And I suppose the other important thing to say is, like, although the I in LGBTQIA does stand for intersex, not every person who's intersex feels that they are part of the rainbow. And that can be misunderstood as well. And it's so hugely important not to remember that intersex people can be straight, they can be gay, they can be lesbian, they can be non-binary, they can be pansexual, they can be asexual, just the same as everybody else. That, you know, that there's a difference between your sex, your gender identity, your sexual orientation, and your gender expression. These are all very, very different things. And the fact that we like to lump them all together in one stew and think that, you know, all these things must line up in a straight line in order for a person to be understood and acceptable, that's what causes the problem, is people's unwillingness to just let people be. I sound like such a hippie from the 60s, but to just let people be who they are, you know, and if you're not harming anyone else, off you go, you know. Let people be. And that there's a common misapprehension that all intersex people are in the rainbow when not all are, or that all intersex people want to be in the rainbow when not all do. Some do and some don't. And that intersex people are no different to anybody from that perspective.
Absolutely not. But the thing is that I think for me, even if I was straight, I was straight once. Thinking about it is that there's so much shared fight, there's so many shared issues within communities.
And that's where the allies become important, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's why I think intersex is part of the LGBTQIA community, but not everyone, as you say, feels the same way. It's like certain lesbians hate the word lesbian or hate the word dyke. They're gay ladies, or they just happen to live with another woman. That doesn't mean they're one of those people. So you can't lump people in together. And there's straight intersex people out there with families, living happy lives or doing whatever, and they don't want to be part of someone's minority community. They're happy being part of their community. And so you have to have that freedom of choice as to be who you are, to choose who you are.
There's a lot of power in the language that's there from what both of you are saying, like how you define the term for yourself and having those terms recognized and respected either in law or in medicine or just within your community itself. And, you know, we spoke a little bit earlier about marginalization. And Diana, I know you were saying that you experience marginalization from lesbians in that community as well. And so there, that sense of interfighting, it just seems very counterproductive as well. It, you know, when the real battle is trying to get access to healthcare and not like brutalizing surgeries and, you know, access to therapy and refuges and mental health support and all those kind of things, not fighting amongst ourselves on that aspect.
I think that's part of what Tanya said earlier, is a lot of ignorance out there.
Mm-hmm.
And ignorance is what stops so many of us coming out, is that ignorance, because you get asked questions that are pretty disgusting or are intrusive or just plain daft when they can Google it and find the information. You don't have to insult someone. If you're interested, find out by Googling it. You know, it's just, it's kind of the, some of the discrimination I faced in the lesbian community, I think, was partly around lack of understanding. Or they think, oh, intersex, that's another bit of trans, isn't it? Which it isn't, but it can be. You can be intersex and trans. You can be intersex and gay. You can be intersex and straight. You can be intersex in anything. It's like, you know, it, there's no one way of being intersex. But it's easier sometimes for people to lump you in with something that you're not, because it makes it easier for them to box you. And if you don't fit that box, then it's better if you're ignored or pushed away. Or, and that's something that I did face within certain parts of the lesbian community when I came out as intersex. Oh, well, you're not one of us anymore then. That's after coming out in 85 and being on lesbian strength marches, body positive women. All the work that I'd done around lesbian identity meant nothing.
Do you think it's, I know you said ignorance there, but is there fear involved in that as well? I know ignorance and fear are very related as well, but is there fear because there's been such a battle to have LGBT sexuality in its, well, lesbian and gay sexuality recognized, and then we're still fighting for trans people to be recognized, and now there's fighting for intersex people. But do you think it's almost a case of pulling the ladder up behind you, you know, and not making room for the other people who have to continue that fight to keep going?
Part of it is around, especially around lesbian, is because we've all been feminists. Not every lesbian is a feminist, but the majority of us have all come out of like a feminist thing because of lesbian rights. Well, you're fighting for women's rights. It's a woman's right to choose what to do with her body, who to love, who to have sex with, who not to have sex with. That we then come up with this idea of, well, we're all lesbians, we're all feminists, we're all women. And then there was this group came up with, oh, well, they're not real lesbians because we're going to gatekeep who can and can't be a lesbian. I'm going to say that that gatekeeping went back to feminist times of, oh, we can't let lesbians in because everybody will think everyone who's a feminist is a lesbian. It's the same kind of battle. And it's one I had with Refuge with, oh, we can't have lesbians coming into Refuge because they want to look at me. They want to touch me. I'll feel creeped out. They want to be near my kids. That was just, it's basically pretty much the same battle of ignorance and, how can I say this, hate speech.
Yeah,
that sounds like that's a good word for it.
Yeah, I think we're always people, as a people, we club together, don't we? We define ourselves both by our similarities and our differences, right? So I'm from Cork, so that makes me a very special kind of person, and you two are just in a poorer place in the world because you are not from Cork. So this special dust that I get that makes me an amazing person being from Cork, you guys have lost out on, and I'm sorry for you for that. But that's what I mean. As people, we club together as tribes. And so we define ourselves by who we're the same as and by who we're different to. And if you are in a very small group that has often been beleaguered, then maybe those borders are extra important because they're so much a part of who you are and how you identify yourself. And so therefore you become like a sort of a gatekeeper on steroids, because you want to keep your little part of the world for people like you, because you found the other rest of the world to be so unwelcoming. But the knock-on effect of that is that you create a part of the world that is grand for you, but is so unwelcoming for others. And so the circles grow tighter and tighter and tighter around what is and is not an acceptable way of being in the world. And that's how discrimination and everything happens then.
Yeah. A lot of kindness in that.
Sorry, I was going to say that is very true for the lesbian community. There's still like a strata of who's an acceptable lesbian within the lesbian community, like BDSM lesbians. How acceptable are they in the wider lesbian community? It's how acceptable is butch, because that's very obviously lesbian on the street. Mm-hmm. There is kind of a media thing within the lesbian community about how great it is, but then again, butch people don't think how great it is when they see how they're treated by other lesbians who pass it is for straight people on the street years ago, as it was for femme lesbians at one time, you know, being stopped at the door to get into a club, you know, can you prove you're really a lesbian?
Yeah, what do you want, just for the two of us to kiss on the street? Like, that's, you know, how are you going to? Yeah, I remember I lived in Brighton for a little bit and I just felt very entrenched between like the butch lesbians on one side and the femme on the other. And it was so stratified, you know, and it just its own power dynamics and everything else. And it was just, it's kind of wild to try and navigate it and try and find out which one am I or whatever. And you're just going. Mm. Hey,
and then you can add in other things like intersex or someone who's trans or... someone who may have had a previous relationship with a guy. In other words, she's not a gold star.
Yeah.
You can get into all those things, but we're kind of taking it, I suppose, a little bit away from the original discussion. Yeah.
That's going to be a whole different podcast, but we are running out of time. We might come back to that on another one, the politics of LGBT. That's probably going to be a different one. Thank you both so much for your time today. It's been absolutely fascinating and heartbreaking and rage inducing, I suppose, to have those experiences and again to still have them going on in the, you know, the 21st century in 2020. So hopefully, you know, Tanya, the work that you're doing, it will change that, and Diana, the work you're doing as an advocate and actually being there on the ground as a counselor for someone, you know, who may be intersex, is just like, it's incredible to be able to offer that to someone. So I really appreciate that both of you are tackling this in very different ways, but that's what it needs. You know, it needs coming from lots of different angles. So Tanya, where can people keep up with your research, and when are you due to be published?
Oh, no, we're due to be published. The pandemic has had just a disastrous impact on our work. It's really slowed us down, because these are not the conversations, when someone's sharing this with you, that it's a very personal conversation. And most people don't want to talk to us through a camera on Zoom. They want to meet us in person. And it's one of the things we've discovered is that these interviews can come in many parts. So there can be a first interview, which is fine. Then you might get a phone call saying, actually, can we meet again? And we do a second one, and you get so much more information the second time, because obviously you've earned your scores in terms of someone feeling that they can trust you with their story, which is a huge honor. And it's a huge thing for someone to do that. So long answer short, it's taking time. It's taking longer than we expected. So we're hoping we'll have something soon, but it's going to take a bit longer. We do, however, have something very exciting coming up. So, Monday week, the 26th of October, is International Intersex Awareness Day. And 2 weeks later on the Sunday, which is November the 8th, is International Intersex Day of Solidarity. And one of the things that we've done with our project is we've been kind of helping Intersex Ireland you know, promote them and giving them a hand as and when we can. They're a newly formed NGO. And one of the things we said we would do is try and raise public awareness. So Minister Patrick O'Donovan, who's the Minister of State with special responsibility for the Office of Public Works, has come on board. And on November the 8th, we're lighting up loads of public buildings around Ireland purple in solidarity with the intersex community. So big, huge things like the Rock of Cashel, Liberty Hall in Dublin, City Hall in Cork, City Hall in Dublin, the Convention Centre, the National Concert Hall, the Mansion House, loads of places around Ireland are going purple for intersex on the 8th of November. So we're really, really excited about that. And if nothing else, it should get people going, why is that purple? Which then hopefully will have people, you know, talk about it. So you can find out about what we're doing at our website, which is dcu.ie/intersex. We're on Twitter at Intersex Map, or you can follow me at Tanya Niem, although I'm not the best tweeter in the world. I'm not the most prolific at it. But that's how you find me.
Brilliant. That is groundbreaking to see.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah. Over 20 places so far, and we're hoping more will come on board.
Amazing. Amazing. And then Diana, you are a prolific tweeter, a lot more than Tanya anyway.
Yes.
Well, not so much quite recently as I've been studying hard, but I do tweet a bit. Yeah. So mine's just Diana James end intersex surgery on Twitter. If you find that, you'll find me.
And you're always a fan of the podcast, retweeting us so people can find.
I love it. Yeah, I love your podcast.
Oh, I know you're a star. Thank you for your support. And thank you both so much. It's absolutely been educational and fascinating and conflicting emotions over everything and just everything. But I suppose that's the joy of sexuality and gender. There's no easy approach to it sometimes, but I'd love for people who are listening to follow along. You know, it's going to be Intersex Awareness Day today, and like Tanya said, that event is on November the 8th, so I want people to get involved in that, and people listening all over the world as well. Please do get in touch, because there probably is intersex communities in your country. You know, the podcast is listened to in 36 countries, so it's highly likely you will have a community where you live. So please try and get in touch and get that support and kinship from other people if it's there. So thanks everyone for listening. You can find the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We are on Twitter and Instagram at Glow West Podcast, and please do pop over to Apple and rate and review, or you can follow us on Spotify, or if you want to keep the podcast going, keep the mics on, we are at Tortoise Shack or patreon.com/tortoiseshack, and I'll chat to you next week.